Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 30th, 2004. Today's session number is DEJ-2004-01. Today's speaker is John DeGraff. The lesson for today is Choosing Time, God's Voice versus Societies, the Reality of Overwork in America Today. Let's listen in.
I'm John DeGraff, and really glad to be back here at Holden Village. This is the fourth time I've had the opportunity to be here and meet all kinds of wonderful people and spend a little time away from the rat race. And some of you are getting to spend long periods of time, I think, away from the rat race. And it may be for some of you part of the reason why you're here at Holden to escape that side of our life and our culture. I know that the theme this summer is summing out what we shall be, and it's about our calling and our vocation. And I think it's something we need, of course, as people always to think a lot about. What is the work that we do? What is the importance of it? How can we make it a contribution to God's creation, to our fellow human beings, and all that is on this wonderful planet? We also, at the same time, though, can't forget that other occasion, vacation. And I think in our society, the emphasis has not necessarily been on vocation, but it has certainly, as a society, been on work. Work to the detriment of virtually everything else, including, I think we all know, the Sabbath. We've become a 24/7 society so that we do things all the time, and it doesn't matter. There's no more holy day or holy time. Any time is a time to do business, to make money, to work, and so forth. When Jesus was in the desert, in the wilderness, and was tempted by the devil, and the devil asked him to turn the stone into bread, and Jesus said, "We don't live by bread alone." But in this society, I think increasingly we do. And I think of bread not in terms of just real bread that we eat, but bread as stuff, as money, as material things. And I think this is a society that is increasingly living by bread alone in those terms, and is increasingly hungry for those things that nourish our spirit. Families, friendships, creation stewardship, all kinds of things that don't get enough time because we are concentrated on the producing and the consuming and the bread, if you will, in the absence of all of those other kinds of things. Back in 1912, when women walked out of the textile mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, a very famous strike, they carried banners that said, "Bread and Roses." And their slogans, as they marched through the streets of Lawrence, Massachusetts, were, "Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread and give us roses. We need bread and we need roses." And I think there wasn't so much, again, about just bread, but or real roses. It's more about time to smell the roses. It was more about that other side of life. It was really understood, for example, for a century of the American labor movement, that as we progressed and we became capable through advances in technology, science, and all of those things, to produce more things faster and faster, that the benefits we could enjoy from all of that would take two forms. One of those forms was the bread, in this sense, higher wages, to buy some of the material things that could make life better for people. But the other side of it was time. That was the roses. There was always the sense in the labor movement that, along with higher wages, people needed shorter hours. that work time be cut so there would be more time to do all of those other kinds of important things that we need to do, to take care of each other, to take care of our families, to take care of the earth. Instead, I think we've gotten into a society that's forgotten all about that, that really has concentrated on the higher wages, the stuff, used all of the gains that we've had in productivity to make more money and to make more things. And not only that, but to really fill our lives with so many things that keep us constantly rushed, busy, feeling stressed, and feeling hectic. And I think there's a big religious issue in all of this, because in all of that, in the 1920s and the 1930s, for instance, the clergy and our faith traditions worked together with the labor movement in saying that people needed time as much as money. And they said that people needed time to know God. They needed time for the Spirit, for all of those kinds of things. So I'm reminded that in this hurry-up world, and I want you to interrupt me anytime you like and comment on these things, but I was reminded of a movie I saw about 30 years ago. It was and some of you may have seen it. It's a movie about the life of St. Francis. It was called Brother, Son, Sister Moon.
Yeah.
Anybody seen that film?
Yeah.
And in the film, Francis is portrayed in a sense as a rebel against the incipient materialism of his day, characterized particularly by his father, who is a rich textile merchant and whose riches in part come from the exploitation of his workers and those around him. And Francis asked the question, you know, what's it all about? He says, this business, this busyness that so consumes my father to get this stuff. And Francis speaks out and asks that people remember what Christ said about the lilies of the field, that, you know, neither sow nor reap but are clothed more beautifully than Solomon in all his glory. And in the movie itself, if you've seen the movie, is pretty Hollywoodish. I mean, every shot was filmed in what we call, it, in the film business, the golden hour, when the light is just right and things look particularly beautiful. Lady Claire, St. Clair, looks more like she just came off the set of a Lady Claire All commercial. But nonetheless, and the music is all by the folk singer Donovan, who some of you may remember, and it's sort of sappy in general. But I remember one of the songs from the movie, in which the words went, "If you want your dreams to grow, take your time, go slowly. Do few things, but do them well. Simple gifts are holy." And that's a message that just is not part of our life in this society today. If we were to sing a song for what we're told to do, it would be, if you want your dream to grow, hurry up, go faster. Do a lot, then do some more. Work should be your master. I think that's really what we're told day in and day out about what life is about in this society. And if we were to think about it, we'd probably understand that we really have an 11th commandment, which is remember the cell phone and keep it handy. This is a busy, busy kind of society. It wasn't supposed to be all like this. What I remember is, I know there's a couple folks here from Superior, Wisconsin. And I remember back in 1968, I was a student at the University of Wisconsin in Superior, and I was studying sociology. And we were told in the sociology class that America was going to face a big problem at the end of the 20th century. One of many big problems, but this was one of the problems that we sociologists were going to have to help find an answer to. How many people would like to venture a guess what that big problem is going to be? Joe?
Leisure time.
What about leisure time?
We have too much of it.
We were going to have too much of it. A U.S. Senate subcommittee in 1965 predicted that by the year 2000, the American work week would be somewhere between 14 and 20 hours. As Dave Barry says, I'm not making this up. We would have 7 to 10 weeks of vacation a year, and we would all have so much leisure time on our hands, we wouldn't know what to do. Now, I have to admit that even back then, I thought that was a problem I could deal with. You know, compared to all those other problems out there that we were facing in 1968 and are still facing and repeating today, I thought this wasn't so bad, you know, that I could figure that out some things to do with that leisure time. Did you?
Trying to get my wife to come sit down.
Pardon?
Oh, my wife. Family time.
But, as you might have guessed, we didn't get it, all the leisure time. Now, we got the advances in productivity. We got the technology. We got the automation and what we in those days called cybernation, the coming computer revolution, so that we can now produce more than twice as much stuff per hour of work as we could back in the 1960s. And in fact, if we had chosen to trade all of those gains in productivity for time instead of stuff, it might have come out the way the Senate predicted. Or we could have done something in the middle, taken a little of the advance in the form of more material things, but at least some of it in the form of more time. Well, instead, as a society, we took all of those advances in productivity in the form of more money and more stuff, and none of them in the form of more time. And in fact, we're working today, generally, as Americans, longer hours than we were back in the late 1960s. And we always have to put a caveat on this because we have to understand what, whenever we talk about the aggregate and we say, that, you know, we took it in the form of more money and more stuff, we have to understand that we didn't all get that. When we talk about the general numbers and say that we're consuming nearly twice as much today as we were then, we have to understand that we've also had a far greater division, an increase in the gap, in the division between rich and poor since that time. And that means that some of us have gotten a lot more of it, and for those at the very bottom, they've seen neither any gains in time, in fact, they're working longer, nor have they seen gains in their material standard of living. But nonetheless, as a society, we are richer today. We have, in general, much larger homes, larger cars, more things, certainly all kinds of electronic equipment and things that we never even imagined in those days. But we have less time, and we are highly stressed, I would argue, as a result of it. We are not only overworked in the society, but we've kind of carried that whole productive goal into other aspects of our lives. So we suffer not only from overwork, but we also suffer as a society increasingly from overscheduling. And so that you probably know the families that have kids whose calendars look like corporate CEOs' calendars used to look a generation ago. I mean, they're going from this activity to that activity to this activity to that activity with no chance ever to simply be kids. And this kind of scheduling, in many ways, is driving families a little bit crazy, not only the kids, but the parents who are part of it. But there's some kind of sense that if I don't do this, and if my kid doesn't have all these kinds of activities, they won't get into this college, and therefore they won't get into that job, and they won't be able to succeed in the very rat race that is producing this situation in the first place. And then thirdly, we suffer a great deal, I think, from loss of time and from a sense of stress and loss of time from what I would call time thievery. And this is the time that's stolen from us from various activities that we don't really choose and don't want to do, but that in fact come about not from our work or from our overscheduling, but from other aspects of our lives. And so, and I would say that over choice, is the other big one that leads us to this sense of time pressure. We Americans are very, very, we consider choice a very, very important idea. You know, that this is really it. Freedom of choice is a highly vaunted goal for Americans. But what does it mean when you have 40,000 items on supermarket shelves instead of 20,000 items? When you have 285 breakfast cereals to choose from and all of those kinds of things? Well, all of that sort of choice and all of those kinds of options that are out there, number one, they take time, because you're looking around and do that. And then you're also looking now increasingly at when it's food, for example, all the nutritional labels and the things on. So you've got all this sort of choice to make. And it's anxiety producing as well. Psychologists find that people are always thinking, did I make the right choice? Could I have made a better choice? Was this the, you know, could I have gotten something a little bit cheaper if I went here instead of here, should I've driven over here. Take phone plans. When a generation ago, when I was finishing college, there was one phone company that had its problems, but you got your phone bill and that was it. Now you can choose between how many plans. I mean, you could do I go for 200 minutes at $29.95, or 300 minutes at $35.50, you know, a month, or do I take this plan or that plan? And then the same thing is true for our health plans, our 401k plans, and million other things, not to mention, of course, all of the other stuff we never asked for. The junk mail that's coming in that now makes up about 60% of our mail, and that requires that we pay attention to it, because a lot of times it looks like the stuff that's important. So you have to dig through it, you know. And then the spam and the computers, well, you get the idea. This stuff, we're not choosing this stuff. This is being increasingly forced on us as part of our lives. This is a theft of our time, I would argue. And it all together comes together to kind of be, I think, crazy making. So the question is, what does it do to us? And I want to go through a whole bunch of aspects of our lives and potential impacts of this whole time stress and time pressure in our lives, and I want you to come up with the answers. And I'd like to start with health, for example. What do some of you know about, think about that working long hours and constantly being pressed for time, how does that affect our health?
Get sick.
Pardon?
Get sick.
We get sick. And what kinds of things in particular?
Heart disease.
Heart disease. What does it do to contribute to heart disease?
Your anxiety level is higher, your rapid heart rate. Your heart isn't designed to stay at that heart rate as long as it does in a stress-filled world, which most of us exist in this over.
So there's that direct stress impact on the heart. What are some other things that it means that we don't do that might be helpful to our heart?
Well, I was just saying, stress hormones, if you have high levels of them in your bloodstream for long periods, they damage everything, and there isn't anything that they don't, you know, take a few whacks off. So, and you don't exercise. Mm-hmm.
You don't exercise, right? Stress is a big one. We're told that we should exercise an hour a day, but when people are asked, do they? And when doctors that I talk to say that they suggest that, people all say, well, where do I find the time to do that? What about food?
We eat a lot of fast food.
We eat fast food. Faster and faster. And that food is usually more or less nutritious. Okay, I think we think that it's less. Now, there are some other things about our health that are affected. What else do we know is really important to good health?
Sleep.
We don't sleep.
Sleep is one. What's happening to sleep in America?
We're sleep deprived.
We're sleeping about an hour less per night on average. And again, these are all aggregates than we were in 1950, and about 2 hours less than we were in 1900. And, you know, you can do some of this, but the people who study sleep say that you can't have these kinds of sleep deficits all the time, continually. We have 100,000 traffic accidents a year that are caused by people falling asleep at the wheel. Now, fortunately, most of them are not fatal, but nonetheless, sleep deprivation is a very big one. What's another thing that's important to our health?
Spirituality.
That's right. And I think we're losing time for that. Any others? What do doctors actually say is the most important thing for our health?
Relationships.
Yeah.
Relationships, community, friendships, all of that. The studies increasingly in medicine, and in pretty common now in schools of public health and so forth, to understand that the most important single factor, even more important than the lifestyle, is relationships, community, the sense of bond that people have with other people. And we have less time for that. There's a thing, has anybody ever heard of the Rosetto effect? Rosetto is a small town in Pennsylvania. And it is a small town in Pennsylvania. And in the 1950s, doctors were very curious about this particular little town in Pennsylvania because it was quite unique. They found that this town had people who lived a whole lot longer than in all the towns around them. They didn't seem to get sick very often. They had none of the usual diseases that other people had in the towns around them. And the doctor said, what is it? So they said, first, is it lifestyle? They found the people in Rosetto smoked as much. They ate as much fat foods. They drank as much. They did all those kinds of things as the people who lived in the communities around them. They said, is it genetics? Well, they ruled that out fairly quickly. And as they looked into it, they found out that, and they came to the conclusion that the fact was that the people who lived in Rosetto were all folks who had come from one poor part of Italy and come and had a very, very strong community, very, very strong bonds between the people in the community. They really frowned on shows of conspicuous consumption, on people standing out and separating themselves and so forth. And this sense of community and these relationships and these family bonds really resulted in far better health for those folks. The doctors also were noticing that something was going on, that the kids of these people were getting into having a car and having this and having the other kinds of things that other kids in the neighboring communities were about. And the doctors predicted that, in fact, within a generation, people in Rosetto wouldn't have any better health and wouldn't live any longer than the people in the communities around them. And this absolutely turned out to be the case. As the society changed. And so that in public health, this whole idea is called the Rosetto Effect, that it really matters to have community and to have time, especially so that people can be together. So that's a health effect. And then how about we segue from that into families and communities? What do you think all of this is doing to family life? And what have you seen anything of? What kind of things might be the impacts of time pressure and overwork on our family lives? Any ideas?
Microwave.
Here we've got the kind of those quick time things, but
divorce rate is up.
The divorce rate impacted. Went up for a long time now, it's kind of leveled out a bit, but yeah.
A lot of families don't eat together very often. They don't sit together to eat.
A lot of families don't eat together. Actually, nearly half of American kids never have a meal with their family in the entire week. And the number of American families who regularly eat dinner together has dropped by one-third since 1970. And the percentage of families who regularly take a vacation together has dropped by one-third since 1970. So we're seeing these drops, And these jobs are pretty important. They really mean something beyond just keeping families together. University of Michigan long-term study, for instance, found that the best predictor of how well students would do in college didn't have anything to do with how much homework they had, what school they went to. It had to do with whether they regularly ate dinner with their families. Long-term study, been duplicated many, many times. That doesn't get out, but that's a key thing. Yes?
Well, it seems like the time that families are together is much less pleasant. Because there's so many things that have to be done. And, you know, parents are tired and crabby, and kids are tired and crabby, and it's just...
Television's on.
Yeah, and those things are very true. And there's a book called The Time Bind that looks into just what you're talking about, how increasingly, in fact, what hurts families is that family life itself has become such a pressure cooker with all the schedules and all the kinds of things and the stuff that has to be done when parents are working longer and come and have to get all that stuff done intensely, that many of those parents actually look to work as an escape from family life. And they work longer because families themselves have become chaotic, but of course that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It makes the situation worse at home. Television. We watch more television, and some people say, well, if Americans had leisure time, they'd just spend it watching television. But there's an interesting figure out. What countries do you think watch the most television? Countries that have the longest working hours, or countries that have the shortest working hours? How many would say the countries that have the longest working hours would have the most TV viewing? How many would say the countries that have the shortest hours have the most TV viewing? Well, the hands have it. In fact, if we look around the world, there's a pretty clear correlation between work time and TV time. The two countries that have the longest hours in the industrial world, work hours, the United States, we're number one, and Japan, they're number two in terms of work hours. We passed them in the late 1990s. They used to be the workaholics of the world. We're now the workaholics of the world. Japan and the United States watch the most television. The two countries, the Netherlands and Norway, that have the shortest working hours watch the least television. And there's a pretty good correlation in between. Why might that be? Yes?
You're tired, but you're able to do anything else. And the kids who aren't being taken care of sit and watch television. And
get programmed for it.
Yeah, you can easily turn the TV on.
It doesn't take any effort.
It's easy. There's no effort. Exactly right.
And you
know, it's a perfect activity when you're bed, you know, when you're worn out. You can be passive and meditative. It takes some effort to go out and plan to see friends, to do activity, to do all those other kinds of things.
I think TV is also addictive. I think it actually changes.
And TV becomes addictive as well.
In a literal
and that's the problem, baby. You know, these things. If we were to, for instance, if we worked not as much right away, we probably wouldn't see an immediate drop in TV viewing. That would definitely take some time. We might initially even see some more because people don't know exactly what to do. But in the long run, the connection is between more work and more TV.
Oh, I was going to say, we use it as a babysitter too for children to sit there, just go in and watch TV.
Right, so then they get primed. Plus, what else happens when you watch TV? What are the kind of messages we get on TV?
Bye, bye, bye.
Bye, bye, bye.
Doesn't it put you in a dream state? Or not a sleep state? Doesn't watching TV?
If you watch, yeah, there are a number of studies. So if you watch a lot of TV, if you're a regular kind of habitual TV, watch a lot of TV, your brain waves show signs as if you were basically, sleeping. I mean, you are sleepwalking. You are, you know, much more susceptible to messages that come in subconsciously. Yes.
My son, who goes to Boston University, had information. I think he read it, or there was a study that your brain waves actually are less active when you're watching television than they are when you're sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Less active.
So you're having more brain activity during sleeping. Because you're so entirely passive.
Okay. And anyway, one thing that they find is that commercials work better because most commercials are not targeting your conscious mind. They're not trying to convince you of anything logically. They're trying to reach you subconsciously to associate this car with that other pleasurable experience or, you know, this good-looking person or something like that. And this is aimed at your subconscious, and you're more open to that when you're not aware, when you're in this kind of state. So the big message of television is buy, buy, buy. Television is really, its basic purpose is to sell audiences to advertisers. And that's really what it's all about as a business. And I make television, so, you know, I have to be a little careful about how much I condemn television, but nonetheless, what do we need to do if we get caught up in buy, buy, buy? What happens?
Work.
Yeah, and
go.
And so we get, I mean, debt is a big issue here. We have, back in 1996, the United States was the first year that in the United States more people declared personal bankruptcy each year than graduated from college. Now that's happened every year since, and the numbers are going up. So every year now in the United States, more people declare bankruptcy than graduate from college. Back in 1996, we had about a 4% savings rate in the United States, which was the lowest in the industrial world. And right after that, we had 4 years of unprecedented prosperity. The last 4 years of the 1990s, we had more real income, as they say, going to more people than in any period pretty much in our history. And it was a very unique thing that hadn't been happening basically from the early 1970s until the mid-1990s. But it was happening in the 1990s, this big, big economic boom. And we might have expected that people having more money would save, would they save more or save less?
Less.
What would we expect? That they might save more. They have more money. They can still spend a little more of it, but they can save more too. What did we find? The U.S. savings rate by the year 2000 had dropped to zero. Why did that happen?
Credit card zero.
Credit cards. We've had those. But what did people think? You know. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say the gap between rich and poor that you mentioned. You know, it's more and more stuff, but it's fewer and fewer people. So the aggregate of people are struggling more, I think. You know, your average blue-collar type person is really having a hard time making it.
Well, they are now, but in that very short period in the late 1990s, there were some gains across the board. Although the gap still was widening. Everybody was making some gains. Yes, Joe?
I think it might have been because why save for a rainy day if it's never going to rain? You know, prosperity is just going to keep growing, and so you can just lift the limit. There's no need to worry about the future.
That was the sense. And so what happens with all of that is then we get trapped. We're in a what we call a work spend cycle. With debt, there's always the sense, and then you suddenly people, the situation changes. And people find that, in order to keep up with these expectations that I have, which I no longer meet because the situation has changed, I need to work as much overtime as possible or whatever. And I'm not saying that everybody has that choice. We have an awful lot of people in this country who are required to work an awful lot of overtime. And we also, of course, have many, many people in this country working 2-3 jobs just to make ends meet, to be able to cover even the basic things like health insurance and so forth. But what about community life? What might we see in community life from this time pressure and time stress in our society?
There's
There's no time to gather with people.
No time to gather?
And it seems to me as if many people have constructed their home to, in a sense, meet all their needs. That, you know, they have their multimedia there, they have their pool table, they have their videos to watch, and they aren't out on the front porch, and they're not walking the neighborhoods, and they're not, you know, maybe worshiping together. That they're kind of isolating themselves.
Mm-hmm. And we've constructed communities, we've built communities where it's too dangerous to walk, because the problem is. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, everybody drives more, which makes it more dangerous to walk. So the engineers build more wider streets.
And what's one of the reasons people drive more?
Suburbia.
Farther to get to the services.
Because you need more parking since you have to move the place out for you.
Yeah.
Well, in the 1950s, I believe, city planners planned it to make it so that people would have to drive more. Cities were designed for cars rather than pedestrians.
Absolutely, and very badly designed. And we've had this kind of sprawl, which means that we're spending more and more time in the car. But then we choose the car because we'd spend even more time on the bus, because this whole situation has been created so that there's a phenomenal transportation time sink, whatever you choose. And there's more pressure to take the car rather than do either public transportation or walk or bicycle and stuff, because again, you've got to get to these places quicker because you're more pressed.
And the other thing that happens is that the primary people you have relationships with are the people that you work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then those people are often different from the people that your spouse knows, or that your children know.
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
That's right.
And they often live far away from where you are.
That's right. You're far away. Yeah. And volunteering is affected by this, the amount of time that people have to do that. Yes.
Kind of interesting new development is that a sense of community is arising through the internet, but it's a faceless community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the quick community.
Yeah.
It's what you can do fast without having to go anywhere and actually spend any time with people.
Maybe you're going to talk about this, but do you have knowledge or figures about? I was thinking why this is happening, and is there an increase in salaried employment over hourly employment that correlates to our, it seems like salaried employees work till they're done and their job descriptions get bigger and bigger, and there's no limit, there's no overtime pay. Is there something you can speak to on that?
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, I think there are quite a number of reasons why this is happening. And I will get to that, but if you don't mind
my
continuing on this, but that is one of the reasons. There are quite, I think, a number of reasons that, at least I would say, and then I think people may here come up with many more than I'm even thinking about. You know, one thing we've thought about in all of this, too, is that this not only affects human beings, but this affects our companion animals to a huge degree that people are not very aware of. Many of the animal rights agencies are aware of this. The humane societies are increasingly dealing with basically an epidemic of abandonment and neglect of animals, being dumped on their doorsteps, literally, you see these kinds of stories in local papers all over by people who are too busy or working too much to be able to take care of them. But what I say is that even a dog's life isn't what it used to be, because we have this epidemic of animals being neglected because people just are simply too busy. So it affects that too. How about our political life? What do you think this does to politics in the country?
We aren't given time for, I'm up here.
Uh-huh.
We aren't given time for thoughts. And so we don't have any time to actually understand any issues that are coming up. We just get thrown up issues like the advertisement world, you know? 30 seconds and connect it to a sexual figure. Like, you know, so there's no thought for politics. It's just whatever it sells the best.
And I think that's the most important thing about what's happening. When pollsters talk to non-voters after the 2000 election, a About a third of them gave us their reason for not voting, that they didn't have time to vote. Now, I personally think that's a little bit of an exaggeration. I don't think it takes all that long to vote, although sometimes it does, because people work long days and they come to the polls at the end of the day, and they sometimes find huge lines which are really just discouraging for them. Most countries have their elections on a weekend when people are not working. But the pardon?
Psychologically, though, it's like one more thing to do.
Yeah. But more importantly, we don't have time to really understand the issues that we're voting on. And sometimes those issues are very complex. Here in Washington State and in Oregon and California, we're often faced with all kinds of very complicated ballot items and initiatives and referendums and things that we are supposed to decide as voters that the legislature or somebody doesn't want to deal with. And these are not easy issues. But we're asked to make a decision on them. And we face this in Washington State by this consistent as a fellow named Tim Iman, I'm sure some of you have heard of him. He's the initiative guy. I mean, he just comes up with one after another, and they're always about cutting this tax or cutting that tax. And that seems quick and easy, and hey, it's a good thing, because right now, people feel like I don't have enough money, I'm in debt, I'm already in trouble, and a little bit of those extra tax money back is going to be a big deal. So all that. California had 135 candidates for governor on their last ballot. Yes, remember that one? Or they had a recall, and then they had Arnold and 134 other guys on the ballot. We were supposed to pick them.
Also, I've seen this happen personally twice in just a couple of elections, so I'm sure it happens fairly frequently. Certain groups of people, it is harder to get into the polls and do your electing. Certain minorities are definitely discriminated against, and the sheer amount of paperwork it takes to get to the poll, to get registered and whatnot, prevents certain minority groups and other
groups
to get in there. So we're abusing that time issue by keeping.
That's absolutely true. And I think we always have to understand that one thing that really characterizes the United States today is that we're an increasingly polarized society. I mean, we are. Let's go back to 1980. In 1980, the United States ranked about in the middle of the industrial world in a whole bunch of categories. We were about in the middle. We were 13th out of 22 major industrial countries in the world in our relative equality. And that's measured, and it comes out every so often. There was just a thing in the Seattle papers about 2 weeks ago about how that's growing. The way they look at that is they compare the income of the top 20% of the population with the income of the bottom 20%. And they look at that ratio, and then they compare that across countries. And we found in the United States that ratio is now about 15 to 1. That is, the top 20% is making about 15 times as much as the bottom 20% is making. Now, when you use that kind of relative equality statistic, you find that in 1980, the U.S. was just below being in the middle among industrial countries. Where do you think we are now? Dead last. You look at other issues. Relative health, measured by longevity, infant mortality, performance by kids on physical fitness tests, things of this sort. U.S. Ranked also number 13 in 1980, according to the World Health Organization. Now we rank below all other industrial nations and even below a couple of poor countries in the world in terms of our relative health. Work time. In 1980, we were again right in the middle. In 1970, we worked about the same number of hours per year on average as most Western European countries do. Today, we work the most hours of any country in the industrial world, and we work about 350 hours each year more on average than Western Europeans do. So we can take other kinds of, there's a number of other, and my brain is on hold here for a second, but But we can look at a number of these kinds of key categories that measure quality of life in society, and we find that the U.S. has gone from being roughly in the middle to dead last today. Now, to be fair, on the other hand, we have the biggest gross domestic product, as we call it. We produce the most annually, and we seem to measure how well we do as a society on how gross we can make that. That seems to be the be-all and end-all. Our candidates will continually tell us that what they'll do is grow the economy. They can make it bigger. Vote for me, and it'll be bigger. In the debates, as if you elect us, we'll double the size of the American economy in 15 years. Well, no, they can't do that, but we could do that. So we have succeeded in this sense of producing the most stuff, but it's much less evenly divided. It's having all kinds of other impacts, and it's certainly making us work a lot longer. Environment. How might this whole time pressure, this frenetic overwork, over scheduling, over choice, how might that affect our environment?
Everything's disposable.
More and more. Yeah.
No time to think about it.
Use it once and throw it away. When you got a fast life, that's a great thing to be able to do. At least that's what we think. So studies find that the longer people work and the more time pressed they are, the less likely they are to recycle, the more likely they are to use throwaway and convenience items, the bigger is what we call their ecological footprint, that is their impact. And that's takes some time to explain that, so I won't go into that now. But new studies are being done. We haven't done much in this area yet, but we're finding that there's a big environmental impact of having to do things too fast. Part of it is also the food issue. The way we produce food, to speed up all the chemicals, the pesticides and things are designed in order to make the process more productive, quicker, etc. It takes longer, it's slower to do. It takes more labor, takes more time in that sense to do things organically, sustainably, to use less chemicals, and so forth. So I think we see that the whole thing is that we as a society have really become phenomenally time-crunched. And we see the stress from this. I mean, the doctors that talk to us about this consistently. Paul Ballinger, whose wife Susan often teaches the science that does what Joe is doing this time here at Holden. Paul and I have talked about this a lot. Paul is an MD down at the Wenatchee Valley Community Clinic. And he says that, they're really seeing 80-90% of the complaints that people have when they come in, that they have physical problems and things that the doctors need to deal with, are really the direct result of stress from lives that are too fast-paced, that are too pressured, that are too full of these kinds of things. This toll, this result of what some doctors call hurry sickness, other terms for it, is pretty severe. And it's just something that we aren't talking about as a country. And I think this is what really troubles me, is that this is a problem that makes worse, that exacerbates every other kind of problem that we face as a society, and yet it's a problem that simply is not on anybody's radar screen. I mean, when do you hear about these kinds of things being talked about by either political party, maybe not even by third or fourth political parties in this country? And what makes it so unusual is that these issues are absolutely on the front burner everywhere else. They're being talked about all the time. There's continual discussions in the European countries. They go back and forth. There's sometimes arguments saying we're not working enough and we need to add a little on, but the fact is the whole thing is being talked about constantly. This whole idea of work-life balance, of finding enough time to live one's lives. In every country in Europe, this is front burner stuff. And it has been in Japan for a number of years, but in the United States, it's simply not part of our dialogue. Yes?
Could it be part of sort of an authoritarian agenda to keep people from organizing and thinking about their lives and trying to create a better way to live that might be threatening to the state?
Well, I think it has that effect, whether that's conscious. I'm not a very conspiratorial guy. I mean, maybe I should be more conspiratorial. Some people think I'm not conspiratorial enough, but I think it has that effect. I mean, I've had French folks tell me, you know, if you guys had a 35-hour work week and the vacations and things that we have and the time that we've got, you might have had time to think twice about what you did in Iraq.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
The speeding up of productivity, whatever you want to call it, also has an intellectual component. And you see this on universities. You don't have time to do the interdisciplinary, to look at relationships. And so then what happens is the very problems you're talking about, people don't address because they're relational problems. Mm-hmm. You can't split them into little tiny, nice, neat little pieces. And so if you've got university professors in the room, they'd all agree here, but when they went back to their jobs, none of it would appear.
Yes, and I've heard that from academic institutions.
The whole productivity, the students call it plug and chug, cram and flush. That's what they call it. That's their description. And the students, and engineering students, will say, look, I got a choice. I can really learn the subject matter, or I can pass the course. I can't do both. And faculty increasingly are saying the same thing. So it's this demonic cycle we got caught in.
Yeah, and it affects education in a lot of ways. And one of the things that we find out today is of course, that in the more working class schools, for example, the kids are just working a lot more mm-hmm. at the same time as they're going to school. I mean, they just have often full-time jobs at the same time that they're trying to make it through school, because again, that's more polarized as well. And there's no time on campus to create community. I went back to just about a year ago, I spoke back at the University of Minnesota in Duluth, where I once used to work. And there's a place there that where 30 years ago, it's like a coffee house, where 30 years ago everybody used to come and the faculty and students would spend time together there after classes talking about the class stuff, but also about the issues of the day, all those kind of things. I went into that place, it's still there. I went there, there was one person sitting and having coffee. Whole place was empty. I said, what happened? He said, well, people don't stay anymore. They've got jobs, they got this, they got that. As soon as class is over, they're off campus. So there isn't any more sense of an intellectual community. There isn't any time for faculty and students to get to know each other in that sense, and also to talk about these, not even time to talk about the core stuff, much less the big issues of the day.
How does the community college fit into that, where you have your students coming, just day students and no residential?
Yeah, and well, it's always been harder for, in a way, for the community colleges for that kind of thing to happen. But I don't know exactly, because I haven't had as much direct personal contact with community colleges. But the places I have had, yes.
I go to Mountain Community College, and about 20 years ago, there's this huge debate between faculty. They wanted to have a faculty eating lounge, and one of the main movers is like, there's no way we're going to have this, and they don't have it. And what happens, I don't know if it's specific to Mountain Community College, but it's really cool. The faculty do eat with the students, and they do take time. So,
well, that's good. I mean, that's a positive thing, and I think it is happening not as much. But
not undergrad.
That's Portland. Pardon? It's in Portland. Yeah, well, Portland's weird.
Portland, Maine?
No, Portland. That's like, it's like when you talk about some of the good things in Europe and you talk about, say, anything about France, and people go, they're French. So that sort of justifies anything that's bizarre. We don't understand in a way how unusual we are, and if we do, we always think that's a great thing, you know, that it's great. You know, we're number one, and we've got the biggest GDP, and so forth, and you raise these other questions, and people seem to think, well, it doesn't matter. Yes?
What happens when people step away from that? Are they like punished for it in some way, or, you know, why aren't more people stepping away from that?
From the whole rat race
yeah.
and things? Well, you know, I think some people are in their personal lives in ways that they are able to succeed enough, and that I certainly later on in this for people who are around in Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll talk about some of the personal things some people are doing and doing successfully. I think it's very hard though to do in the workplace because we just have much more we're much more insecure in our work life than people in other countries. There's just a whole lot more fear. You're just much more, if you don't want to put up with the long hours, if you don't want to put up with these kinds of things of being called in at any time, you don't really have any protections. For example, you can't make people work mandatory overtime more than, you can't make people work more than 48 hours a week in any European country without they're agreeing to do so. That's just by law. The U.S. has no law at all. You can make people work as many hours as you want, as long as if they're way hourly workers, you pay them overtime. If they're salaried workers, they don't even have that particular protection. And then you can say, well, if you don't like it, that's too bad. We don't have a lot of protections. If you look at Europe, for example, you cannot join as a country the European Union without guaranteeing, number one, a minimum of 4 weeks of paid vacation to everybody after a year on the job. A minimum. That's the bottom. And it goes up from there. And you cannot be in the European Union without requiring that. By law, you cannot be in the European Union without having this maximum on the work week. You cannot be in the European Union without a law that says you can't make anyone work more than 6 days a week. Everyone has to have at least one day, a Sabbath day, or at least one day off per week. Everybody has to have at least 11 hours between work shifts by law. Everybody. I mean, this is just the way it works. And then you look at other kinds of things that people take for granted around the world. It's amazing. It's really amazing how unique we are. The Harvard University just did the School of Public Health just did a study, cross-country study all over the world. They studied 168 countries, which is really the vast majority. There are some 200 countries, but many of them are very, 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 very tiny. But they looked at 168 countries around the world. They found out that 163 of those countries guarantee that any women workers will receive paid childbirth leave. 163 countries. If you're a woman and you have a kid, you get at least some amount of paid leave to take care of that child. Only 5 countries in the where that's not the case, and of course we're one of them. And you can say all these kind of things. In 139 countries, everybody is guaranteed sick leave, paid sick leave. It's just it's considered civilized, and it's the case in even many poor and moderate income countries, not just the industrial countries. So we actually, interestingly enough, have a situation in the United States. I was speaking with a Dutch professor in Amsterdam a few months ago. And one of the things we had been saying about the time thing was that if people didn't work so many long hours and weren't so stressed, that we'd have lower rates of absenteeism at work. Mm-hmm. And he said, don't say that. That's complete nonsense. You in the United States have by far the lowest rates of absenteeism in the workplace. In fact, your problem is your rates of absenteeism are way too low. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, he said, we believe, and we've studied this, and we believe that the rate of absenteeism in the workplace, sickness, absenteeism in a workplace, should roughly equal the percentage of sickness in society over the course of a year. And we've conclude that percentage is about 2.8. That roughly at any point in time during the year, about 2.8% of people have some kind of illness that would keep them out of work. Now, in the Netherlands, our rate of absenteeism is 2.9%. So we're right at that number. In the United States, your rate is 1.9%. You have a third more people who are basically, what are they doing? They're working sick. So I says, your problem is not absenteeism. Your problem is that this is impacting other things, your health and your productivity. Because those folks who are working sick, coming to work because they feel like they've got to be there to show up, and often because they've got so much work piled on that they feel that if they're not there, they won't be able to keep up with the emails and so forth. Those folks are staying sick longer. They're working less productively. They're making other people sick and less productive as a result. But this is what we do.
There's even a new name for that phenomenon that's buzzing around. It's called presenteeism.
Presenteeism. I love it. Presenteeism. One of the things about, I think about the Christian message that's always been a big part of that message for me is the message about humility. It's the message about understanding, I think. Part of that message is understanding that we don't necessarily have all the right answers, that we don't always have the best way of doing things. There's a lot of wonderful things about our country, but there are many, many things that we can learn from other countries. And I think we ought to start thinking about the fact that we are really alone compared to the rest of the world in how we look at things. How we look at, understand that parents need time with their children. I mean, that is just something that is ignored here. In many cases, I mean, the average amount is 6 months of paid leave for mothers, and in many cases, in 45 countries, for fathers around the world when people have a child. The U.S. has no requirements of any kind of paid leave. We do have the Family and Medical Leave Act, which allows 12 weeks of unpaid leave for parents if you work in a company with over 50 employees. Now, only about 40% of American mothers are able to take that. Many because they work in smaller companies and can't get it, and others because they can't afford to, because it's harder for the poor to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a few cases in the software industry where I work. One that I knew really well that came back after maternity leave, part of it paid, a very small percentage, and then either quit or lost their job because they're so behind after this.
So behind, yeah. Yeah, and vacation is, of course, another one. 100 countries in the world have some kind of guaranteed minimum vacation. Like I said, in Europe, 4 weeks. We have none. So we have a situation where Americans average about 2 weeks of paid vacation. But nearly 40% of women in the United States earning less than $40,000 a year get zero paid vacation. It's quite staggering. And the other countries, they call up, they're always doing news stories of how Dutch TV call, they said, we're doing another story about how Americans don't get any vacation. And then I told the Dutch television people that we don't get any childbirth leave. And they said, what? This can't be. And I said, no, really, we don't. There's no guaranteed childbirth leave in the United States. And they said, wow, you're kidding. No. And they said, well, that's even more amazing than the fact that you don't have vacation. I mean, surely you understand that mothers and fathers have to spend some time with their kids. You know, it's just important that they bond and all that. And they're getting to the whole line about why parents have to have time with very young children and how it's going to cost the whole society more if these kids don't have that kind of proper bonding and this sort of stuff. But with a little humility, we might learn something from these other places. Yes?
Maybe I'm getting ahead here. What do you think is in our DNA, our belief system, our thought life, our personality as a nation? Why is this happening? Why are we doing this? Why are we so wound up?
Well, I certainly don't think it's in our DNA. the question, and I'll be glad to talk with you. I am going to go into this. I wasn't going to do it tonight because I wanted to talk more about the issues and then go into the causes and then into some of the things that we might do to change this thing. And there are a number of things. I will tell you really briefly what I think those things are, but I won't go into detail now. One thing I think is that the role of consumerism in this society, the power and impact that it has. I mean, the whole idea here that the good life is the goods life is much more prominent in this culture than in others. Secondly, the decline of both the change in the role of unions and the decline in unionization. So not just the fact that we have much lower rates of unionization than other countries, but that also our unions, long before that happened, were focused on other things. Their whole emphasis was much more on wage increases for their individual members and far less on those things that before the World War II they had emphasized. They forgot the roses and focused on the bread. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, and most importantly, I think the growing gap between rich and poor. I think inequality is the biggest source of overwork. I think it leads to people at all income levels working more. That's a complex argument, which I'll try to demonstrate how that works. But I think we all, whether we're well off or poor, suffer in that sense from inequality.
You might add this later, but I would say also insurance. Yeah. The fear, your job security is so low because if you don't have a job, you don't have insurance, and so you'll do just about anything to keep the job that keeps you with insurance.
And that's absolutely right. Health insurance, a huge one. Every other country, again, industrial country, has some sort of national program where that's concerned, so that's protected. Most all those countries have a basic higher minimum or living wage than we do, and they have legislative protections for certain kinds of things, which we do not. We have this absolute extreme belief, you know, and some people will say to me, and I've had a lot of people say to me, well, isn't this just capitalism? I mean, don't we have to get rid of capitalism in order to solve this problem? I say, no. All those other countries, those Western European countries, are all capitalist countries. They're all basically market societies. They operate with private enterprises and all those kind of things, but they understand that you can't just let it go to extremes, that you have to have a countervailing force, that you have to say there are some things about the market that if it's just let completely to its own devices, it will lead to big gaps between rich and poor and other problems, so that we have to in some way balance the good things that the market does with some opportunity to do other things and with some strength for people who are left out. So those are there, and there are a number of other, it's a whole lot of things. It's not one single thing. Some people say, is it the
Protestant work ethic. And some people would say, I mean, one guy in the New York Times said, well, it's because those Europeans have been infected with the spirit of secular sloth. Because they don't go to church as much anymore, so they don't have the work ethic that we do, and that's why, and they're going to fall apart. As, and that's why we work long. But I always remind people, well, wait a minute, but in what country is it where everything is open all day on Sunday? You know, where is it? You know, where I mean, there are all kinds of other things in which I think those countries' rules have protected people's right to a spiritual life and those things to a degree that we've absolutely ignored. You know, we don't have any of that kind of thing. But so there are many factors. Yes, Dave.
Regarding the income distribution, I think we ought to also be aware that when you look at what goes on in very wealthy people in high corporations, like I'm studying Enron, there is a fanatical drive for more and more and more. And so it's not just the lack of income. There's something else going on there. I mean, it's sort of crazy. It becomes a cult. I mean, a corporate cult where people are just driven, and you look how much money they're making, yeah. And you can say you could retire tomorrow and, you know, just on the money they've got, and they're still caught in it.
Yeah, because their sense of self-worth is based on the comparison of the salary of the CEO at the next company.
It's a cult-like behavior that's really powerful.
And that's a huge thing. I mean, in Europe, they accept... Those poor CEOs accept the fact that they'll only make about 30 times as much as their average workers make. I mean, I don't know. They're really, I'm sure, deprived. But in this country, it's 400-1, you know, and growing. Yes?
Well, part of it, I think, is we are really, we don't know much about other countries. And we think we know everything, and we've got it here, and it's the best in the USA. And we don't know these things about other countries. I mean, I think you could go out in the street and ask somebody, well, how much vacation does your typical Norwegian have? They don't know. And so in order to realize that you're being exploited and abused, you need to know that it's different somewhere else, I think. And I think we just are bombarded with so many mixed messages, and people just kind of shut down, don't know what to believe, and put their nose to the grindstone. We don't have any basis of comparison.
I think that's
we don't understand our history,
true.
And we don't understand the context.
I want to. I mean, we've gone over time, and so I'm sorry, I didn't mean to sermonize for so long here. But I'd like to just for anybody who'd like to stay around, I want to show you about 5 to 10 minutes of video and. Including just a little tease for the film Running Out of Time, which is a show that I did for PBS on this subject some years ago that I'll show in full tomorrow night for anybody who'd like to see it. And then I also want to show you just a little bit from a show that I didn't do, but a show called Time Frenzy that's more recent. And so if anybody is okay with staying around for another 5 to 10 minutes, I'd like to do that, and then we'll, and I'm happy just to talk to anybody individually, and we'll continue this conversation in the next sessions for whoever can attend. Anyway, I want to thank everybody. If you need to go now, please feel free, and we'll have to start this projector real quick. I'm told it's